Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, trends are changing for the so-called land of opportunity. Where in the world is there equality of opportunity? Then, are the high alerts, embassy closures, and the national surveillance state reasonable reactions to the threat of terrorist acts? Finally, on the Scholar Circle Roundtable, with climate change, depleted natural resources, and more than 9 billion people, what will the world look like in 2050? The trend for economic equality in the U.S. has been changing, with less opportunity for people to transcend intergenerational economic status than they have in other countries, like Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Canada. Why the changes? Miles Korak is with us. He is a professor of economics at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Generational Income Mobility in North America and Europe and The Intergenerational Transmission of Employees. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Miles Korak.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that you have been studying is this gap between the so-called American dream and the reality, particularly with upward mobility. Perhaps what we should start with is that the opportunities for children of the privileged, what you called the 1% in your article, are quite different from everybody else. Maybe we should get a sense of how different they really are and what the primary drivers are.
In one sense, different in the amount of resources these children have, but they're also very different in kind. I think all children benefit from having more monetary resources in the household. But what's happened over the last generation or so in the United States is a very significant increase in the amount of spending that goes to what people have called enrichment expenditures amongst families in the upper end of the income distribution. They're spending a lot more money on things like computers, books, summer camps, extra tutorials, and things of this sort to increase what economists call the human capital of their children. That's just ballooned over the last two or three decades. But it's also the nature of these resources are sort of fundamentally different. It's certainly true that parents help their children at all stages of the important transitions that children go through in becoming adults, not just in the early years, but also through the teen years. And the other thing that really distinguishes the families in the top 1% is the foothold those families are able to give their children in the labor market when the children are in their late teens or early 20s. Everybody relies on networks of some sort to get information about jobs and possible job opportunities. But in the top 1%, you see a very large fraction of children actually being employed by the same employer who employs their father. So in some countries, almost 7 out of 10 kids in the top 1% actually have at some point held a job with an employer that also employed their fathers. And part of that also has to do with, you see this sort of echo in the education system. So children of the relatively well-to-do are on a different educational track through more selective high schools and colleges.
One of the other things that you've done in your work is comparative studies, comparing the United States with other similarly situated countries that are wealthy. How different are they with regards to this phenomenon?
The United States is different in the sense that the degree of inequality is much higher than in other countries, and therefore we see the amount of resources for the top 1% being much higher. So there is a significant difference in just the resources available there. But there are also differences in how those resources end up structuring fundamental institutions like the education system and the healthcare system. So in the U.S., you see a more divergence. For example, if you make a comparison to Canada, children born at the top are much more likely to become adults who are in turn raise the next generation of children at the top. And similarly, if you're born at the bottom, you're much more likely to stay in the bottom in the United States than in Canada. So there are significant differences, and I think part of that has to do with the structure of labor markets as well.
You also looked at, I think it was Denmark and Sweden. How did they compare with the U.S. and Canada?
Well, in terms of mobility, Denmark is probably the most intergenerationally mobile country where family background is very loosely associated with a child's ultimate adult success. But I think we also have to be careful in making comparisons like that. Denmark is a very different country, much smaller, not just geographically, but also much more demographically homogeneous. Some of the comparisons that I did focus on tended to be towards countries like Canada, which are also share a lot in common with the United States. But the other lesson we have from these countries is, you know, inequality has gone up, for example, quite significantly in Sweden and in Canada as well. Not as much as in the United States, but these countries have also seen a rise in the share of income going to the top 1%. Yet somehow in Sweden, for example, even though there's this dynasty amongst the top 1%, the rest of society stays relatively mobile and can still live with that dynasty. The starting point for this study was something that the outgoing chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, called the Great Gatsby Curve. That involves a comparison of dozens of countries. We've just focused this discussion on those at the two extremes, the most mobile and the least mobile. The most mobile include not just Sweden and Denmark, but also Finland and Norway, and the least mobile include not just the United States, but also the United Kingdom, Italy, and France. And then there are a bunch of other countries in the middle.
Now, if we were going to draw lessons from what Sweden does, would you say it's a public policy question or a cultural question or a behavioral one or all three?
Well, I think in this discussion, it's important to hold more than one possibility in your mind as you think this through. For me, and for the sort of the economic theories that have informed some of my work, there are three fundamental drivers of a child's future prospects. Clearly, the family is a very important institution, determining how children get a start in life and promoting them throughout their lives. But families also have to mesh with labor markets. And so the structure of labor markets also matter. The more unequal labor markets are, the more unequal wages and access to good jobs are, the less mobility there'll be. And finally, between the family and the labor market is the state and public policy. Public policy can be designed to be progressive in the sense of being of relatively more benefit to the less advantaged, or it could skew things the other way and be of relatively more benefit to the advantaged. So I think we can have different opinions upon which of these institutions are the major drivers. As a labor economist, I tend to see the labor market as being the important driver and that meshes these other gears, the family and public policy. But in the United States, all three of these things, institutions are configured in a way that leads to less mobility and less opportunity for the less advantaged. Public policy tends to be less progressive. The U.S., for example, spends a good deal of money on education, but it doesn't level the playing field as much as it could. It spends a good deal of money on social policy, but it goes mostly to the elderly, older population. In the U.S., the labor market is much more unequal and much more polarized, and family structures are also more polarized.
The article that you wrote for the New York Times, you opened it with a little vignette about Jan Wenner, who is the publisher of Rolling Stone, as an example of some of these underlying dynamics. Why did you choose Wenner? And then how common is his story to America's story?
It was just one example that happened to have come up more recently. I certainly did not want to pick on him and the fact that his son now runs RollingStone.com. But it's easy to find many examples like that. As I suggested earlier, the use of families and networks is very common across the entire income distribution. But it's particularly notable amongst the rich. And I can find examples of this sort in countries like Australia and Canada and many others. But I think the point of picking up on an anecdote like this is to emphasize that opportunities aren't the same across the income distribution, but also to stress that one important aspect of rising inequality that hasn't been fully appreciated is the degree to which it forms opportunity and the degree to which it'll be passed on to the next generation. If the children of the very well-to-do are also more talented than average and have more skills, as the little anecdote seems to suggest that Mr. Wenner feels is the case, then it doesn't negatively impact on the productivity of the economy. But evidence, in fact, shows that that's, on average, not the case. So this is an example of inequality begetting inequality, not for reasons of productivity, skills, or talent, but because the playing field is not as level as it could be.
The other cultural belief that you think is maybe even holding up this continued dynamic is this belief that people in the U.S. can be upwardly mobile. Do you think this is a myth? And what do you think the costs of that are?
it's a myth, might be going a bit too far. I mean, there is a good deal of mobility in the United States for the broad middle of the income distribution, but it's very sticky at the top. But to the extent that people tend to justify their position in life because of inherent talent and more skills that they have, that sort of forms our attitudes to public policy. If it's all about your own efforts and personal responsibility, then you're less inclined to support public policies to level the playing field, give the disadvantaged a stronger foothold. And the view that my article tries to address is that, well, that's a very important part of the American dream, that anybody can make it with sufficient energy and talent. And if a very influential part of the population believes that, those in the upper fifth, then they're much more inclined to project that on everybody else and therefore skew or structure public policies in a way that doesn't really promote mobility. In a very real sense, the American dream is still there to be had. That's why many immigrants wish to come to the United States. But what we're talking about here is sort of one's relative position in society, and opportunities are not as fluid as we often think they are as a result.
Do you think that it was once more egalitarian with more opportunities for mobility than it is today? And is that where the belief started?
The idea of American exceptionalism and the American dream has a long history in U.S. discussions. But certainly, at least some studies have found that the degree of intergenerational mobility was much higher a generation or two ago than it is now. As a result, Americans, to the extent that they continue to believe that, would be willing to accept more inequality than many other countries. The point of my article was also to illustrate that that's changed. People who grew up in the 50s and 60s faced a very different family structure, a very different labor market than those growing up in the 80s, 90s, or the early 2000s. I think there's a greater awareness now of that over the last decade or so.
If you were going to design policy from this point forward, drawing from those that are more successful in enabling people to be economically mobile, what would you say the most important ones are?
I think that's a very good question, and there's certainly a lot of discussion about that in the literature. James Heckman of the University of Chicago has pointed our attention to the very important role of the early years. So, for example, the recent proposal to extend kindergarten to four-year-olds, I think, would be a very important policy to pursue. Professor Heckman's highlighted that the return to an extra dollar of investment in the early years is much greater than in the later years. Other things that we could do certainly should be directed to supporting the family, particularly parents with the young children, trying to reduce stress loads in the family, perhaps through more parental leave or options for leave or more flexibility in daycare provisions. And the third set of policies would revolve around trying to develop a more equitable labor market in which lower-skilled jobs aren't paid as poorly as they are now.
Well, Miles Corak, thank you for joining us once again on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, the U.S. State Department issued a global travel alert. The Obama administration closed some two dozen outposts and justified the NSA's surveillance program. But our next guests suggest that the government may be overreacting and that the chance of being killed by an act of terrorism is far less than other dangers, such as gun violence. John Mueller is a research scientist and professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of War, Presidents, and Public Opinion. Mark Stewart is a professor of civil engineering and director of the Center for Infrastructure, Performance, and Reliability at the University of Newcastle in Australia. Together, they have co-authored Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, John Mueller, Mark Stewart. You've kind of opened your argument in your book saying that we've really not been asking the right questions. Maybe the right one isn't, are we safer? What do you think it should be, John Mueller?
Yes, it should not be, are we safer, but how safe are we? And that's where you'd really begin. The question is, do you want to spend more money to become even safer than you are now? And virtually no one ever brings up that question. You can calculate pretty easily, and a reasonable estimate is your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year if you're an American. And that includes 9/11 in the calculations. So the question, if you start from there, is that safe enough? Now, maybe you'd argue that, no, I won't be safe until it's 1 in 4 million or something, but that's the kind of discussion that should be there, not simply have we improved safety marginally from where it was 10 months ago or 10 years ago.
Mark Stewart.
The next question is, if you're going to spend a lot of money on homeland security measures, how much does it actually reduce that risk? So then you have to think about, well, if you can reduce the risk by a certain amount, that gives you a benefit, and does that actually exceed the cost of that measure? And in most cases, we've found that because the existing risk is so low, additional risk reduction actually causes a very small additional benefit. The costs are way, way higher than those potential benefits.
You compared the likelihood of being harmed or killed in a terrorist act versus other potential ways of dying, such as traffic accidents, industrial accidents, natural disasters. Let's break some of those down. John Mueller?
Yes, if your chance of being killed is 1 in 3.5 million, and you could argue that it's actually even lower than that, but if you start with that, you can certainly compare it to, for example, your chance of being killed in an automobile accident in the United States, which is about 1 in 8,000, or 1 chance in 22,000 of being a victim of homicide, or 1 chance in a million of dying by drowning in a bathtub, or 1 chance in about 7 million of being killed by lightning. Now, that's not the end of the discussion, obviously, and a lot of people point out correctly that terrorism has additional ramifications because it terrifies people and causes disruptions in the economy and anxiety more than some of those other hazards. So that should definitely be considered, but that's a good place to start. What is your chance of being killed, and do you really want to spend money on making it less likely that an American will be killed by terrorism when the chances now are 1 in 3.5 million, or, say, improving cancer research, or putting in smoke alarms, or reducing the dangers of driving on the highways.
Or gun violence.
Yes, definitely.
Mark Stewart?
So the risk assessment methods that we're actually using are nothing new. I mean, they've been applied to a whole range of existing hazards, going from nuclear power to hurricane protection to flood protection to pharmaceuticals to EPA regulations. So all we're really asking is that that same degree of scientific rigor gets applied to the hazard of terrorism.
Some of those hazards that Mark mentioned are very politically dicey. For example, in particular, nuclear radiation. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to very much consider that. It's not simply what the damage might be, but the emotional impact, etc. So regulators have for decades been dealing with these kinds of situations, both hazards that don't carry a huge emotional impact as well as ones that do.
Now, is the risk so low with regards to a terrorist attack because so much money is spent?
No, I don't think so. It certainly contributes. And obviously, you can start by saying, well, this is where it is now with the amount of spending we've been doing. And the question is, do you want to spend even more to make it even lower? Or if we relax some of the strictures that have been put in, it may increase the likelihood you'd be killed by a terrorist a little bit. But with that money, we could spend it on other hazards which have far more lethal. It's not terribly clear. You know, 9/11 is standing out as this extreme aberration. It has not been a harbinger. And the various people have been caught and detained and have been incapable of creating remotely that kind of violence. So consequently, it's not obvious that the measures that have been put in place have stopped a huge number of 9/11s or things that are even worse.
Particularly, many of these measures took 2 or 3 years to actually implement after 9/11, and there were no attacks immediately following 9/11. So you could almost argue that maybe the threat isn't as high as we think it was.
So let's talk about how much money we actually do spend. You've calculated some of that. Where do we spend it, and how much do we spend it to battle terrorism?
We looked at direct federal government expenditures, state and local government expenditures. And these come out to something like more than $700 billion since 9/11. And then if you start to include some of the opportunity costs, such as the fact that if you make flying difficult for passengers, it becomes actually not a particularly pleasant experience by having long queues at the screening channels and all sorts of other issues, then if you actually divert people to driving to the destination rather than flying, then that actually costs lives, because flying is much, much more safer than most other forms of transportation. So any security measure that actually deters people from using a safer mode of transport actually is costing lives rather than saving lives. So when you tally all of that in, the total cost exceeds more than $1 trillion since 9/11. And then if you include the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's another $1 trillion. So we're talking about serious amounts of money.
Let me add also, that is the increase since 9/11, not the total expenditures.
And then, of course, we've seen cutbacks in other programs and a lot of budget fights lately. How does this fit in with the politics that's going on right now in Congress?
Since budgets are not infinite, you have to make choices. The politicians and bureaucrats have to do that all the time. And so consequently, it seems to be their profound responsibility when you're dealing here with public safety, which is the foundational reason for government to begin with, that that money should be spent in a way which improves public safety for the maximum amount, given how much money you have to spend. So to do it emotionally or to do it in a way that is extremely and absurdly risk-averse means that basically you're spending money that doesn't save very many lives when you could spend that same money that would improve public safety considerably more. But as far as we can see, that kind of calculation, which is extremely basic and straightforward and simple, is not really put into place when you get into this area.
Just to follow on John's question, the other thing that's a concern is the expenditure is still increasing. It shows no sign of trying to level off. So the issue is, you know, where do you draw the line? And when we compare the expenditures to the UK, Australia and Canada, US expenditures probably 2 to 4 times higher on a per capita basis or per GDP basis or any other standard metric. So the US expenditures really stands out compared to what other countries are doing.
And what is it that you see that it's primarily being spent on? I saw some of the things in your books about every time a container comes through customs, there's just all this extra process. But what would you say the top anti-terrorist expenses are?
Probably the biggest single lump of money goes towards the Transportation Security Administration, and that's really aimed at the aviation security. And if I had to pick something from aviation security, it would be the Federal Air Marshal Service. This is the service that has about 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals. And the intent of these is to sit on aircraft and to try to stop potential terrorists accessing the cockpit door to stop a repeat of the 9/11 attacks. And 3,000 to 4,000 air marshals sounds like a lot of air marshals, but there's something like 60,000 flights a day in the United States. So they only cover probably no more than 5 to 10% of flights, and that's both domestic and international. They cost more than $1.2 billion a year. So it's a very expensive service. Since they hardened the cockpit doors, you know, very soon after 9/11, that really closed the vulnerability. And in the last 11 or 12 years, the air marshals actually have done nothing. There hasn't been a single terrorist incident that they can claim to have averted. Other countries don't have air marshal services. Australia has actually cut back on its number, and there's a large number of European countries who actually never even had them. So that's probably one of the specific items of expenditure which we think is heavily excessive.
The $1.2 billion they're spent on the air marshals is about the same budget as the entire Los Angeles police force. Another way of looking at this is that after 9/11, in a state of panic, a huge amount of money was thrown at this problem. Now, that's perfectly understandable. We all remember the atmosphere after 9/11. The most basic kind of common sense is that when you spend a lot of money in haste, whether it's government or business or personal, you're likely to misspend a fair amount of that money. After a few years, one would think, you'd want to go back and revisit those expenditures. Some of them, maybe just out of pure luck, proved to be really quite cost-effective and really valuable in reducing the risk at a reasonable cost. Others surely have been wasteful because they've been so hastily put together and so under-considered. So what we've been trying to do is to do exactly that. And I must say, quite surprised at in many respects, is that no one has done this really systematically, including the Department of Homeland Security. It's 12 years now. After 2 or 3 years, you'd think, well, we should do a stock taking. Or maybe after the administration changes and you say, okay, we've been through this thing for 7, 8 years now. It's not time to see if this is really sensibly put together. But as far as we can see, that hasn't been done.
Now, with the revelations of the NSA and Edward Snowden, I'm assuming these would be even extra costs that you didn't get into your calculations.
They're somewhat in there. About 45% of the increased expenditures have been on protection, like TSA and putting border guard and putting up bollards around airports and so forth. And another 45% has been on increased policing and intelligence. Our book mostly deals with the former, the protection measures. You know, it doesn't make sense to try to fortify a building against a terrorist attack. And a lesser amount in the book, the Terror Security and Money book, deals with policing. But we're now beginning to look at that as well to see if the FBI, for example, and their $3 billion they spent on counterterrorism, whether that's cost effective or not.
Now, I was also struck by how much fear people still felt and concern about terrorist attacks years after 9/11. And some of that, you said, is a result of, it's a kind of a new coining of a term, the terrorism industry. How would you characterize this?
That's my phrase there. What happens is you have people who are very much afraid of something, and then you have a lot of people who see, hey, there's gold in those hills. And so you have basically politicians, bureaucrats, and people selling things to the government realize that there's this need, this fear out there that they can basically service and do well at, and the media, by the way. So there's a tendency to exacerbate the threat. If you're going to sell x-ray machines to the government and you find the government really is desperately suddenly in need of x-ray machines, you pussyfoot it quickly over to Washington. And when you get there, you don't say you don't really need these x-ray machines. Instead, you're likely to sort of exacerbate the threat. In terms of the public opinion, however, and that's the driving factor on this in many respects, I think, it is impressive, as you mentioned initially, that the fears of terrorism do not seem to have subsided much since the end of 2001. For example, when asked on polls at the end of 2001 whether they were worried that they or a family member might be a victim of terrorism, about 40% said yes. That number still is pretty much at that same level, even after the death of bin Laden and even 12 years later. So I don't think necessarily the terrorism industry has created this perception, but they certainly have an incentive to exacerbate it and to work with it.
Mark Stewart?
There's also no reason to, in a sense, to link public opinion to what the actual expenditures are. In the Australian experience, we had our Prime Minister at the time was John Howard, and he was a very close ally to George Bush and the US.
In Australia.
In Australia. And his rhetoric was extremely strong. I think George Bush labelled him the man of steel and all those sort of very strong statements. And the Australian public liked that. And he was also very successful politically. But the spending did not match the rhetoric. And that's the thing. You can still be strong on terrorism, have strong statements, have a lot of public support, obviously spend some money, you know, to close some of the important vulnerabilities. But you can still be successful politically. So I think what the US is sort of stands out amongst other countries is how the spending has almost exceeded the rhetoric.
Another way of looking at that is that although the public is definitely saying, I want to be safe or safer or whatever, it doesn't follow that they're saying, we want to take off our shoes before you get into airplanes. We want to have air marshals on a large number of flights and so forth. So even though there is this concern out there, it does not mean that politicians have to spend $1 trillion. And as Mark suggests, that other countries have also felt pressure. They have spent more money, definitely, but not nearly as much proportionally as the United States, and those politicians are still in office. So the argument that the bureaucrats and politicians frequently make is we have to do this because, you know, otherwise we'd be thrown out of office. It simply doesn't bear up under that experience.
When you look at the budget fights that are going on now, it would seem that they would stop and think logically about how much we really need to spend to have that little bit more safety. But it really speaks also to the power of fear, how debilitating fear can be, and the behavioral consequences. John Mueller?
Yes, they can. If you've got 40% of the people worrying, if your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million, the idea that you worry about it at all is pretty absurd. But no one is ever saying this. One politician once said something like this. It was Mayor Bloomberg in 2007. And that's where the discussion should begin. And I suppose from the bureaucratic standpoint, the problem is if you say, well, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 3.5 million per year, you're afraid that the answer will then be, well, then how come we're giving you so much money? The important thing is to spend the money in a manner that maximizes public safety, not simply to preserve your job or your department.
Our experience has been is that the public actually gets it. They can see the risk of terrorism compared to other hazards. They can see that the spending seems out of whack of what the actual risks actually are. So once you actually go through and explain the process and put data and numbers to this and compare risks to other hazards, it doesn't come across as controversial at all.
Thank you so much for being with us, John Mueller. Mark Stewart, it's great to have you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
When we come back, what will the world look like in 2050? Stay tuned. You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. More than 9.6 billion people will live on the Earth by the year 2050, according to the United Nations' latest estimate. Given the planet's limited natural resources and the changing climate, what will the world be like in 2050? Three experts join us. Lawrence Smith is a professor and the chair of the Department of Geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the author of The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization's Northern Future. Edward Miguel is a professor at University of California, Berkeley, and the director at the Center for Effective Global Action. He is the author of Africa's Turn and co-author of the study Quantifying the Influence of Climate on Human Conflict. Deepak Ray is a postdoctoral research scholar at the Global Landscapes Initiative Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. He is co-author of the study, Yield Trends Are Insufficient to Double Global Crop Production by 2050, and Solutions for a Cultivated Planet. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I want to start with Lawrence Smith and the big drivers that you see shaping the world that you wrote about in your book, The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization. How would you describe these drivers, and how do you think they might really shape the world collectively and individually?
The four drivers that I examine in this book, which is really just a projection of trends that we already see in the world today, are in fact very familiar to all of us. Put simply, they are population demographics, the statistics of birth and death and migration, estimated demand for natural resources, especially in response to the growing economies of the developing world, globalization in all its many forms, and climate change. So basically, people, trade, resources, and climate have always shaped the path of human civilization and behavior in the past and will continue to do so in the future.
Can you give us a sense of what the trend is and what it's pointing to in each of these cases? So starting with, say, demography.
The big trends there as we look out to the middle of this century, if you accept the sort of middle-of-the-road projections of the United Nations demographic model, is that we're heading to a world somewhere a little over 9 billion people by the middle of this century. Could be higher, could be lower, but nonetheless, we're talking a substantial increase over today. Furthermore, not only will we have more people, but we will have wealthier people and a larger consumer society, which in terms of the resource demands and economic requirements for that, this signals a many-fold increase in the ecological footprint of people on the planet, one that even exceeds the gross number of new souls on Earth. With regard to the others, resource demand in particular, we see growing demand as reflected in commodity prices all around the world for hydrocarbons for the foreseeable future anyhow, certainly out for the next two or three decades, as well as any host of metals and rare earths and so forth. Globalization, that trend is sort of the least assured of all of them. World War I showed how quickly a globalization trend can be upset in a short period of time. But nonetheless, the current trend that we see, if we extrapolate it in the future, is a continued global integration, both economically and culturally. And then the fourth, of course, is climate change. Make no bones about it. There's no question that the world's climate is changing quite rapidly, particularly in the high north, and this is going to be with us for decades, indeed centuries to come.
One of the things from your book when you talked about climate change and resources was the issue of water, and specifically how not even just necessarily water to drink and shower with, but water that's necessary for farming.
As my two colleagues on the show will quickly concur, water equals food, and agriculture is the largest consumer of water. And as we move out to a wealthier and larger global population, we're going to need a lot more food, ballpark, roughly doubling the amount of food that we currently produce out to 2050. So water is, in many cases, a critical limiting factor for that.
Deepak Ray, let's bring you in. You've been studying how food and agriculture demands are changing and what that means for the future. Why don't you first give us an overview of what you found?
In our study, we are trying to figure out whether the trajectory at which the demand for global agriculture is increasing, that trajectory is being met by the agriculture production at the same time. So what we find, if you have to double global agricultural production, that basically translates to 2.4% increase in agricultural production each year between now and 2050. But what we have found is that we are significantly falling short from that particular number.
I know the demography, which we have been just talking about with Lawrence Smith, we have more people, but you cited a couple of other drivers in addition to a growing population. Can you talk about those? Why is it that we are needing to produce more?
So Lawrence talked about global population is going to be above 9 billion. Actually, the UN has revised it upward. Now it's going to be 9.6 billion, perhaps even more. So that's between the 7.1 billion humans we have on Earth right now and around 10 billion by 2050. That's 30% increase in global population. The other two-thirds of the increase in demand is because as we get wealthier, and history has shown this time and again, as people move from the poor class to the middle class, we demand more richer food, like more meat and more dairy products, which are very grain-intensive to produce. So because of the losses in the conversion of grain to meat and dairy products, the demand for agriculture is significantly higher. And then there's the third piece, and that's the demand for biofuel crops. So part of our food crop gets diverted to grow biofuel, like ethanol in the United States.
Are you actually saying that vegetarians have a smaller footprint on the planet than meat eaters?
If you think in terms of grain, yes. If we just shifted our diet slightly from, say, beef, to maybe more chicken, then it significantly reduces the amount of grain lost in the conversion system. And if you just go completely vegetarian and have more grains, then it shifts even further. You can feed several million more people.
I imagine when we have a scarcity of anything, we have some concerns with human relations. But Edward Miguel, your research suggests that it's not even necessarily just the scarcity of resources, but the climate itself that causes some breakdowns in relationships. Can you tell us what it looks like could happen with climate change?
Our research focuses on the link between adverse climate and human conflict in many different forms. In our recent work, we pulled together many different sources of information and evidence and data sets as we could. We actually looked at 60 studies across the globe, including wealthy countries, to estimate the statistical relationship between extreme climate conditions, adverse climate conditions, with different forms of conflict, from violent crime all the way up to society-wide forms of conflict like civil war and civil conflict. And we found a very striking pattern. The relationship we were able to identify across all these studies is as societies experience more extreme precipitation, as they experience hotter and hotter temperatures, we're more likely to observe increases in violent conflict. Now, in thinking forward over the next 40 years or so, as my fellow panelists have done, this is a very important finding, I think, and a concern because there's a consensus among the climate scientists that the world is going to warm probably by at least 2 degrees Celsius, which is almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit, by 2050. And we're probably going to experience more variable precipitation patterns. So when you take that together and you really think about the implications of these historical relationships for the future, there could be considerably more human conflict as the climate changes.
Their trend has been for a decreased amount of political violence and deaths. But it sounds like what you're saying is that might be kind of a short-term thing because of this phenomenon of heat or the variable climate and violence. What do you think it is about the climate?
I think there's a couple things there. First, the issue of whether conflict overall around the world, say civil conflict, is declining or rising is actually debated. It really depends on the type of data that you look at. In some of the data series, if you look at the most extreme form of political violence, so outright civil war, there has been a decline over, say, the last 15 years. You know, the 1990s were an incredibly violent decade, but there's been some decline since then. But if you look at what's called a lower level civil conflict with fewer deaths, in some of the data, the incidence of that type of conflict is actually rising over the past decade. So it's still debated, I think, globally whether we're seeing less political violence and political instability. Now, different disciplines come at these issues with different perspectives. As part of our paper that just came out in Science, we tried to pull together data from as many different disciplines as we could because it turned out academic researchers in a variety of fields, we're focusing on these issues, but sometimes using different methods and approaches and different data. And so there's a whole branch of literature in psychology documenting the link between high temperatures and aggression. And that even holds in a psychology lab. If you turn up the dial in a psychology lab, people act more aggressively. And so that basic physiological or neurophysiological response could be part of the story in explaining our results. Now, on the other side, I myself am a development economist, so I think a lot about agriculture and rural poor populations. When we think about the economic consequences of very high temperatures and extreme precipitation, we think about the impacts on crop yields and on agriculture. And there's a variety of studies showing that as temperatures get very hot and as conditions get very dry, crop yields can fall quite sharply. So the resource scarcity issues that Lawrence Smith was talking about could very well be part of the story here as well.
Deepak Ray, now you didn't in this particular study look at climate as one of the factors, but you've looked at it in other studies. How do you see climate fitting in with the ability to feed people?
This has worried almost everybody, whether extreme precipitation or extreme heat waves like we saw in Russia in 2010, by their miscalculation in policies or whatever, they decided to put an embargo on exports and the price of wheat everywhere increased and there was a shortage in the market. So those types of things, actually trade, globalization and everything, they all work together. And if one particular breadbasket is going to get hit in the future, or maybe a couple of them at the same time, it's going to create mayhem in the world economic system. So climate change could, and perhaps in many places would, decrease crop productivity. But in some countries of the world right now, the way they do their agriculture is already under threat. So I'll give an example of, say, Yemen. Yemen does a lot of its agriculture based on groundwater, and they basically are running out of groundwater, and they are not able to sustain their productivity of wheat. And their population is growing at the same time. So what do you expect? In, say, the next 20, 30 years, their per capita wheat production is going to be much lower. The next in line is perhaps Saudi Arabia. So there are many, many basic problems already building up in our agricultural systems, and it connects with the water, it connects with our climate, and it connects with our society and globalization all together.
Lawrence Smith, this is a major theme that you've written about. How do you see this?
Yes, globalization plays into this food, water, security nexus in some very interesting ways. As Deepak just pointed out, now when we have a disturbance or a crop failure in a place like Russia or United States in Iowa with the floods in 2009 in Iowa, the global grain prices went haywire. Even in those markets that would not necessarily be receiving physical grain from those places. On the other hand, if it wasn't for the global food trade, the world would be much less food secure than it is today. The Middle East, for example, is unable to produce enough food to feed its people. It relies heavily on imports of food in order to sustain the populations that it has. And this is not unusual within the United States. If we didn't have the flow of grain and silage and meat products out of the heartland out into the cities, we would not be able to sustain a distribution of people where they live. Instead, we would all be farmers like we were in the 1800s, living closer to the sources of the food itself. So globalization both increases the risk and vulnerability to global price shocks in response to a crisis anywhere, really, yet also buffers and enables people to live where they do today.
A couple of other things that relate the three of you together. Lawrence Smith wrote about what's going to happen, say, for example, in the North. Will there be Arctic wars? Lawrence Smith, you thought history points to greater cooperation in times of crisis. Do you think that that is a counter to what you're hearing from your panelists, or do you think that it could be really quite chaotic?
No, I think the example you're referring to was specific to the Arctic region itself, and particularly the allocation of offshore sovereignty in the Arctic Ocean, which is sort of widely perceived popularly as somehow being a free-for-all frontier and all these countries pouring in to stake out their claims. But in fact, the sovereignty claims in the Arctic Ocean are proceeding rather calmly and smoothly under the provisions of an important international treaty called the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. But with regard to the global picture, as Edward was pointing out, depending on which data set you look at, you can see different trends. While it's true that huge wars between nation states, and then the casualties from that have been declining. And this is argument often made by Steven Pinker, for example. The lower level conflicts, civil war, or not even quite a civil war, at a lower level of internal conflict between countries, those can be seen to be on the rise. So, no, I don't in any way suggest that somehow the world is heading towards kumbaya.
Edward Miguel, you wrote about the times when society actually completely breaks down and what the conditions are when you have like a major institutional collapse. What are those conditions?
One of the things we sought to do in our work was to bring in as many studies as we could across fields. And one of the fields that has studied the long-run implications of climatic change are the fields of archaeology and history. So we actually brought in data wherever we could on historical episodes of sharp climatic changes. And these are, you know, I think for listeners, they'd be familiar with the use of tree rings or sediment deposits to measure climatic conditions even 1,000 years ago or more. And it turns out there's actually a growing number of studies that document that there have been major impacts on empires, civilizations, really entire political systems when those societies experience extreme climate. So some of the cases that we document, you know, when we brought studies together was the collapse of the Maya civilization in the 9th century AD. The classical Maya civilization collapsed after a century of mega droughts. There were actually three separate multi-year mega droughts that the Yucatan experienced. And at the end of that, the classical period of Maya civilization ended and society descended into conflict and breakdown. Several Chinese dynasties collapse actually coincides very closely with sharp drying periods in China. Similarly for the Akkadian Empire in Mesopotamia thousands of years ago. So obviously those are historical cases and the instances I mentioned occurred a long time ago. So there's always going to be a question of relevance for the modern world given how much our technology and our institutions have changed. But, you know, at the time, these were the most advanced political systems and empires in the world, and extreme climate really led to their demise. And I think that's a cautionary tale and, you know, very much consistent with the kinds of patterns we see even in the modern period on the link between extreme climate and violent conflict.
Well, let's take a look around the world, take a little tour, if we could, to see where we see the trouble spots, the potential solution spots. Let's start with the feeding people. Deepak Ray, where do you see the biggest problem areas? How do you see the contrast?
There are really just two crops in the world which feeds like 50%. So half of our average human diet just comes from rice and wheat. And then if you add the third, corn and the byproducts from corn, like via meat, then more than half the daily human energy is met from these three crops. So if you have to talk about problem areas in global agriculture, you just have to start with these three crops. And what our results show is in the larger countries of the world, there is not going to be too much of a problem in terms of per capita production as we move forward in time. They are going to just hold steady where they are, or they slightly increase, or it's not too much change. But in the smaller countries of the world, there's going to be lots of huge problems. I'll give an example. Edward brought up the issue of Maya, and Guatemala comes to my mind. So a large proportion of the daily dietary energy in Guatemala is from corn or maize. Yet, while their population is increasing rapidly, the productivity of corn in Guatemala is going down. So that's a big problem area. In Africa, where corn is a very important food crop, most of the African countries have their population rising rapidly, whereas their corn productivity is not keeping pace, or worse, they are actually going down. And that is also true in many other countries. I'll give one more example because we are talking about conflicts. Afghanistan. Afghanistan has done pretty well in terms of improving its wheat and corn productivity in the last 10 years or so, but their population growth is so fast, so rapid, that the per capita production is actually going to go down as we move forward in time. So there we have it.
Well, Lawrence Smith, you talked about migration patterns as well in your book.
We could take a trip around the planet and see how all these trends are unfolding in quite different ways around the world. I'll perhaps just talk about one that is perhaps beneath the radar for most people, and that is the string of 8 northern countries which circle the high latitudes of our planet, north of 45 north latitude, except for Europe. And these would be the United States, which is a northern country, Canada, Greenland, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, and Russia. These countries, too, are changing quite rapidly, particularly in their far north in the Arctic, which most people are aware of. The ice is shrinking there, and there's a variety of feedbacks and processes that are unfolding very rapidly there now. But even the countries themselves and their major capital cities are growing at rates quite surprising for the developed world. For example, Canada is projected to have a population increase of nearly 30% between now and 2050. Now, that's 30% of a small population. We're only talking about 33 million people living in Canada now. But for the internal economy of Canada and its trajectory of demographic and economic growth, this is quite significant when compared to other developed countries, for example, Korea or South Korea, Germany, of course, Japan, which have actually fallen, declining population projections out to the middle of this century. So these 8 countries actually are changing quite rapidly. There's a lot going on, and in many ways have a positive future relative to some of the outcomes in other parts of the world.
Edward Miguel, hotspots of the world?
I think the northern latitudes, Lauren Smith is totally right. The sort of absolute increase in temperature at extreme latitudes is actually going to be very large. The sort of absolute increase in temperature that's predicted from climate models closer to the equator is actually considerably smaller. But one of the things we've looked at in our research is what historical variability looks like year to year in temperature. And it turns out that closer to the equator, even though the absolute increase will be smaller, historically the year-to-year variability has also been much smaller. So a 2 degree Celsius increase in temperature, say, in the Sahel region of West Africa or certain parts of Southern Africa or certain parts of South Asia, that's actually a very large increase relative to historical measured variability. So even though the absolute increase looks smaller and we might be tempted to think that climate change might thus affect tropical regions less, these are very substantial increases for those regions. And when we focus on certain regions that even today are quite hot and dry, again, like many parts of West Africa, they're starting at very high average temperatures. So a 2 degrees Celsius increase when your average temperature is already high is quite substantial. My own personal research focus is mainly on African economic development. I think there are some major challenges around agriculture going forward, in particular when we think about a 2 degrees Celsius increase to 2050, and the consequences could be quite important. Of course, we focused in our study on impacts on conflict, civil conflict, but there could be major implications for migration patterns and broader regional economic development.
Let's turn then to potential solutions, what you think we should be doing as a civilization, humanity. Deepak Ray?
So as my good friend and mentor Jonathan Foley has also framed it, in terms of global agriculture, it's a civilizational problem that we need to debate and decide on, whether we want to try to increase global crop production to feed everybody or we want to actually reduce the demand. Both of them have different consequences. So if you want to reduce the demand, we have to change our diets, for example. We have to reduce waste, but history shows us we are on some other trajectory. Our diets are getting more and more meat intensive. Like 500 million Chinese middle class in the next couple of decades, they're going to demand all meat and dairy products. So it's a civilizational question, really. If you're going to try to increase global crop production, how you're actually going to be able to do that? Where is the water to do so much? Where is the road networks, for example, in Africa, to bring the fertilizer to the farmer? So really, there are two sides to it.
Lawrence Smith?
If there's one thing we should all be focusing on in the years ahead, it's weaning ourselves off of our appetite of hydrocarbon fuels, because so many of these issues and problems are ultimately tied up with that. The climate change trends we're talking about don't stop at 2050. They will continue to grow and continue to get warm until we get this transfer of carbon from beneath the ground and into the atmosphere stopped, so at least the growth of it stopped. Also, our entire modern food production system hinges critically on the abundance of cheap fossil fuels. Our fertilizers are made from natural gas. are mechanized agriculture, which is enabled or forced, depending on how you look at it, people, labor force to move from the rural countryside to the cities is enabled because of cheap fossil fuel and these large mechanized machines that grow it for us. So to my mind, moving to a new energy regime is critically important.
One thing with the fossil fuel industry, I think that the cheap fossil fuel is because it's subsidized largely. So perhaps the new regime will at least examine the subsidies. But the other thing is something that you wrote about, Lawrence Smith, and that is how much less water it takes to generate wind and solar versus the others.
There's a marriage between water and energy that most people don't think much about. Even the government agencies in charge of water or energy don't really speak to each other. But it takes one to produce the other, and there are some surprises in there. For example, hydropower, which is a wonderful, clean, renewable source of energy, actually has enormous water losses when the reservoir is located in a dry area, which makes sense, of course, because you have huge evaporation pouring off of the top. It takes a lot of energy to bring water, pump it upstream, uphill to Phoenix, for example. So there's a tension there as well.
Edward Miguel, potential solutions. What do you see?
Lawrence Smith just mentioned what's called mitigation issues, thinking about reducing carbon use. And that's obviously going to be critical going forward because these climatic changes will continue to get driven as long as we're burning so much fuel. Another issue that needs to be front and center in policy terms, especially because efforts at mitigation seem to be stalled politically at a global level, at least for the moment, unfortunately, are adaptation approaches of various sorts, and I think Deepak Ray pointed to several of these. When we're thinking about the kinds of economic channels that we're interested in and that link climate to conflict, again, if there is extreme climate and there's an economic breakdown, it could lead to more conflict. There's a number of adaptation approaches that have to be pursued. And, you know, when we think about a drying climate, say, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the development of technologies that are more drought resistant, that produce better crop yields even at higher temperatures, is a absolute first order policy priority in my view. It's very challenging to develop those technologies, but there are some efforts underway. I think those need to be intensified so we can at least maintain livelihoods in some of the rural areas that are hardest hit by the coming changes.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lawrence Smith is a professor and the chair of the Department of Geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the author of The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization's Northern Future. Edward Miguel is a professor at University of California, Berkeley, and the director at the Center for Effective Global Action. He is the co-author of the study, Quantifying the Influence of Climate on Human Conflict. Deepak Ray is a postdoctoral research scholar at the Global Landscapes Initiative Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. He is co-author of the study, Yield Trends Are Insufficient to Double Global Crop Production by 2050. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.